Interview with Gene Freeze, July 21, 1990, at Cincinnati, Ohio.
Gene is a Cincinnati fan. I mostly remember you as the third baseman for the 1961 pennant winning team, where we came from nowhere and won the pennant. What can you tell me about that season?
Well, they came from about 7th place from the year before. I was traded from the White Sox over here as a combination of Juan Pizarro. Then they went on to get Joey Jay, Don Blazin, eventually they got from San Francisco. So
yeah.
Involved with a pretty good club.
Nobody expected to come through, and it seemed like during the season they were counted out a half a dozen times and still managed to come back. And then managed the very interesting series with the Yankees, and even though they supposedly been overpowered.
They were supposed to be like the second best winning team in baseball.
No. Well, they were all close except that last game.
Well, yeah, but of course, Mickey and Roger had a home run door, and Roger had 61-61.
And then what was so unusual is to go into the streets with his weak or inexperience of catching as we had with Edward Zimmerman and Johnson.
We had 6 catchers that year. Nobody knows that. We had about 6 or 7 catchers that particular year. It was hard to win a pennant with that many catchers.
Yeah. I was talking to Ed Bailey earlier, and he reminded me that that they got Schmidt for him.
Oh, yeah, we want to play. We got rid of Bale. Oh, he's kidding about that. We got rid of him, and that's how we got Blazer game and Schmidt. And then we had a guy before him, Hal Bevin, who broke his finger in spring training on the first pitch.
Oh, I forgot about him.
He was going to be our first string catcher. They was really grooming him. He broke his finger the first day, the first pitch. So he lasted about a month, and that was it. Poor Hal died in 1968.
Oh, did he? Well, you helped come up with the spark, and everybody credited you with a good part of turning the team over.
Well, he did. My best year I ever had was that year. 26 home runs, close to 280, 87 RBIs. Gordy did the same thing, Gordy Coleman.
Yeah.
It was hard to win a pennant with me on third and Gordy on first. If I'd catch it, I wouldn't win how I was throwing it. And we didn't know if Gordy was going to catch it. So it was kind of, that damn near killed Hutch that year.
Yeah.
The poor old Hutch waited for 3 more years to do it on it.
Well,
it was tough on Hutch to see us out there.
Had good pitching and relief pitching with Brosnan and Henry.
And Henry, they were left and right. We had the Guns and Navarone out there, Pinson and Robinson.
Yeah,
that was the same year the Guns of Navarone came out.
Oh, yeah.
The movie? So that's what we called them.
Uh-huh.
And they had a fantastic year. Of course, we had like Lynch, Romy, Bell, and Post.
Yeah, strong outfield.
We had a strong left field element out there.
Then, like you said, they picked up last game during the season.
Second base, Chico, Cardenas, and Casco at short.
And then after waiting that long for a pennant, then they came along with expansion, and we lost part of the reserve strength, and we had to give up for the other teams. What we lose Bell and somebody else, and then wasn't it the very next spring? That's what I said. The very next spring. I can still remember that picture.
No, very clumpy took
it.
That was a good thing.
Yeah.
But the thing is, that was the last year that we only had 8 teams in the National League. Yeah. We got 10.
Yeah.
What people don't realize that.
Yeah, there was 1 year difference.
That's when I expanded the nation, because I broke my ankle. So I couldn't play with a lift in 62.
Well,
then the next year I came back in 63 with Pete Rose. That was Rose's first year.
Yeah.
Second, I was third.
Yeah, he eventually be out.
Chico was at short and Gordy was at first. In fact, I got a picture of him 2 years ago. Pete's last year was magic.
Well, Casco played in the 61 team.
Casco and Cardi.
They
were both there.
Okay. But that was kind of enjoyable because we didn't expect it, and then here we're waiting for the next season, and then we're crippled before we get out of spring training, and that kind of hurt. Well then you had quite a few years after that.
Yeah, they never expected me to come back. In fact, the doctor said it's a miracle he could walk and running. I come back in 63 and become a regular third baseman again.
And then all of a sudden,
but then again, I wasn't going that good, and shipping out to San Diego. Then I went out there and hit about 10, 12 home runs in the first month. Finally, they had to bring me back because we was losing, and we were still fighting for the pennant. Then they traded me back to the Pirates after that. So they told Bill the good I wasn't going to play anymore. Because I liked the way he treated me or the rest of the players. I said, get me out of here. Of course he did.
But he traded for you though, didn't he?
He traded for me, and he traded and he got rid of me. In fact, I'm on a telephone in 1963, November 22nd. I'm sure you remember that day when Kennedy got shot.
Yeah.
And Joe Brown from Pittsburgh was on the phone to me. It's 12:30, and I'm watching As the World Turns. I'm sitting at home watching As the World Turns. And Joe Brown called me and said, hey, Augie, we just traded for you. I said, who's this? Said, Joe Brown. So I hung up on him. I thought, somebody's flying around. His phone rang again. Called up again. He said, Augie, now don't hang up. I just got you from Cincinnati. I paid more money for you than I did for Kozuski when I brought him over here back to the Pirates. I said, Joe, thanks a lot, but you know what just happened on the TV? The president just got shot down, and he didn't know it.
He's busy.
He's busy. He's trying to get me in trouble. And there's a president just got shot down. And I had a broken wrist at the end of the year. He said, well, I want you to fly up and get the wrist taken care of. I said, okay. And he really didn't know it. But that's when I got traded back to the Pirates.
Then how many more years did you have after that?
Well, I went to the Pirates in 64 and 65. And he traded back to the White Sox. They needed some extra help. He was going for the pennant there, so I went over and finished it at 287.
Were you there the year they won the pennant?
No, I got there the year after they won the pennant. They won in 59.
Yeah.
And they went and got me from the Phillies. And I led the club in home runs. And I sold off the Phillies. And they got me and Sears and Minosa. They went with power instead of speed and pitching with a pitching fold. We lost about 3 games. But that was every year after they won.
And then what was your last year?
66.
66.
I ended up finally in Houston. With another Hall of Famer going in, Joe Morgan. They brought me over to take his place. And he got hit with a pitch on the knee or something like that. I thought it was fractured. So they got me from the White Sox. Stanky was over there and got me back over to Houston. Now, I ain't played second base in 10 years. I still haven't played it because a cool guy named Ronnie Brand there and he started hitting the ball. But I ended up not playing hardly at all. But that was it. I 2 years in Hawaii.
Did you?
And that was it.
Then did you, did you stay in baseball in the next format?
I came back and managed in 73 with the Milwaukee organization in Shreveport, Louisiana. But I live in New Orleans. A good time. A lot of good ball players. That's about it.
And you've been retired since when?
Well, since 74. I'm a lounge down the wall. Neighborhood type ball. Neighborhood type table. I don't tell anybody where it's at because I don't want them to come down. I don't want all ball players in there ruin my reputation. So I figured I was on the other side of the bar a lot. I might as well get on the other side and see what they look like. So Tool used to come down here all the time. He'd bring his baseball teams down.
Well, it's been a lot of fun, and it's good to relive the memories with the people that you still play.
I'm just sitting here looking at Carlos and signing balls over there, and I got my first big league hit off of
him. Is that right?
1955. I never let him forget it.
I guess he did real well for the time that he was up. I guess his career was cut short by injuries or whatever. But certainly appreciate it, Gene. Right. Thank you very much.
Candy.
This was an interview with Carl Erskine on July 21st, 1990 at Cincinnati in connection with the Equitable Old Timers game. Carl, I just wanted to start and go through your career with, I guess, was probably 100% with both Brooklyn and Los Angeles Dodgers.
Right.
You were with the team when they moved.
I started the team right out of the Navy in 1946 and played 2 years in minors, came up in 48, and played 10 years in Brooklyn, 2 in Los Angeles. So my whole career, 14 years with the Dodgers.
You got into five World Series with the while you were there.
Our club won 5, and then they won in L.A. the second year, which was six series in 12 seasons. And we missed winning the pennant and being in the series at least 2 other years on the last day of the season. the Thompson home run year in 51, and in 1950 we got beaten extra innings on the last day to nudge us out. So we had a team that's almost every year of the 12 I was there, we were a contending team and could have won the pennant 9-10 times in that stretch.
Well, it was a colorful group right there, and then you remember lives as Boys of Summer and in the book, and it really, the whole country was following the team, and it was very prominent. Of course, you were at that time, there weren't too many pitchers to pitch two no-hitters in your career. You had two no-hitters during your career.
I was told by Hugh Casey when I first came up that he said, there's some guys that hit 340 every year, Carl, and they're going to hit you. I've never seen you pitch, but they hit everybody. So my advice to you is bear down on the guys in the lineup ahead of them. That was good advice. The other thing he said was, Ebbets Field is very small. You know, 296 down the right field line, 318 to right center, right in the power alley. Only 318 out there, and the fence was high, but you guys could rain the ball off of there. Well, he said to me, Carl, let me tell you another little bit of advice. There's some things in this league you can't change. You can't change the weather on the day you're going to pitch. You can't change the park you're pitching in. And you can't change who's umpiring back of the plate.
Uh-oh.
He said, forget it. Forget it. Well, there were a lot of guys very intimidated about Ebbets Field because it was so small. But that helped me, and I pitched some of my best games at Ebbets Field. In fact, both my no-hitters were at Ebbets Field. And so I think Hugh Casey gets a lot of credit in my mind for helping a young pitcher to get over that intimidation of pitching in a park that was not advantaged toward the pitcher.
Yeah. You heard so many people complain about the parks that they're pitching. It's there to pitch. Go out there.
Well, some guys had taboos about certain parks, and they liked this one, they didn't like that one. And that helped me to pitch whenever my turn came up, wherever I was. And so I was able to do that without any real... I didn't have any real park that I felt was my nemesis.
I'm gonna ask you. I know one of your no-hitters was one pitcher, one batter away from a perfect game.
Right. Well, Phil Caffredo just came in here a minute ago, and the first thing he said was, you no-hit me, and I was manager. Well, he was a playing manager, incidentally. But, yeah, in 52, I started a game against the Cubs, and we scored early. Warren Hacker started against me, and we got some runs early, and they brought Willie Ramsdale in to pitch in relief, a knuckleballer.
Yeah.
Well, it looked like it was just going to rain cats and dogs any second. And we had a five-run lead, so we're hurrying, trying to get five innings in. And Ramsdale comes up, and I throw him, just trying to, he's a terrible hitter, weak hitter. I just wanted to get the ball over. Well, I threw four straight balls and walked him. Then the rains did come down. 40 minutes later, after the rain settled, they got the canvas off, and we came back, rewarmed up again. I finished the game. Nobody else got on base. So it turned out that Ramsdale, the weakest hitter in captivity, was the only base runner. But who knows? He might have got a hit. Who knows?
Better to hit, yeah.
You know, well, a little quick sidelight to that game. We went in. Our club liked to play bridge. Most ball players play hearts and pinochle and whatever. We learned to play bridge. Everybody loved to play bridge. So every time there was a break in the action, you could go inside or before the game, after the game, on trips. Guys were always playing bridge. So when we went off the field that day when the rains came, we went in, sat around the trunks, and had two or three bridge games going. So I just made four hearts in the hand, and they yelled 40 minutes later and said they're going to play. So went back, pitched, and it became a no-hitter. So after the game, the writers are saying, well, it's a very unusual no-hitter. I mean, you had a 40-minute delay, and what'd you do? I said, well, we came in, you know, sat around, played bridge. So they wrote that in the paper. Next day, the clubhouse guy yelled at me, Charlie DiGiovanni, and he said, hey, Erskine, you went on the phone. I said, who is it? He said, Charles Gorin. I said, yeah, sure. So I go back there to... I says, hello, Carl, this is Charles Gorin. I said, it is? He said, oh, no, it is. He said, this is Charles Gorin. So I read the paper where you were playing bridge yesterday. I said, that's true. And he said, well, you know, I'm the bridge columnist and expert. Could I recreate your hand in the paper? And I said, well, if I could remember, but I can't. But Charles Gorin became a friend of the Dodgers through that. He used to come to the clubhouse and, in fact, play bridge with us in the clubhouse. But that was kind of a sidelight to my no-hitter.
Well, I can't let you get away without telling about about being in the bullpen on the day of Bobby Thompson's famous home run.
Oh yeah,
I heard you give story in person, and I saw it written up, but I have to have you repeat it here if you don't mind.
Well, of course, that season, 1951, we'd made a big trade early in the year and got what we thought was going to be our salvation, to have a left fielder, Andy Pafko. And Andy was a fine player. We got three other players in that trade, but that was going to really give us our solid outfield. Well, we got a big lead that year, and we were 13 and a half games up on the Giants in August, and they were coming strong. They played unbelievable down the stretch, and we played about 500 baseball. Not bad, but not good enough. And on the last day, we got caught and had to go in a 2 out of 3 playoff. Lost the first game. Levine pitched the second, which shut the Giants out. Then we were winning the third, and I'm in the bullpen, along with Branca throwing in the late innings. And Newcomb had pitched so many games with 2 days rest down the stretch. Newcomb had been a workhorse, and he was rolling along well in this game. But he got into the ninth, got a couple men on, and Ralph and I are cranking up in that bullpen, boy, and a call comes down from Charlie Dressen. Are they ready? And Clyde Sukaforth, our bullpen coach and catcher down there, one of the catchers, said, yeah, they're both ready. How are they throwing? They're both throwing okay, but Erskine's bouncing his curve. I had this big overhand curveball, and once in a while, if you get it low, it would bounce. So with that comment about the curveball, Dressen must have said to Sukaforth, let me have Branca. Ralph came in the game. That may have been the best curveball I ever threw. I don't know. But the fate was on Ralph's shoulders, and you know, the home run, again, in those days with the parks so peculiar in size and distances, the polo grounds was real short down each line. And Bobby Thompson's home run was a sinking line drive. It was hit hard, but it wouldn't have carried out of any other park in the league. But it did sink into the lower deck of the polo grounds. I don't know, 320, 330 feet away. Somebody knows the distance. But it wasn't a towering drive. It was a sinking line drive. But it was good enough for four bases and the pennant and the most famous home run I suppose ever hit. Yeah. I went to the clubhouse from the old polo grounds. The bullpen was around each side toward deep left center, deep right center for each team. But the clubhouse was in straightaway center, 600-700 feet away from home plate. We were the first to get in the clubhouse because we were nearer. So I got in there. I got to watch all of our team come in. And I really sensed kind of the history of this thing, because even though we were on the bad end, as soon as I got in the clubhouse, up the steps in the clubhouse, they were moving all the TV cameras through the doors from our side over into the Giants' side. They were carrying cases of champagne out of our side over into their side. Then the doors shut, and it was like a tomb in there, because it was, the bedlam was all around the outside, but in our clubhouse was just still like death. And I watched each player. Robinson came in. He fired his glove into his locker in disgust. Dressen came in. He ripped his shirt off without unbuttoning it. Hodges quietly walked over and laid his glove in the upper part of his locker. Reese, with his head down, walked in. I just watched these guys and thought, this is really a historic moment. Then came Branca. And I was never superstitious. In fact, I worked at trying not to be. But when Ralph flopped down on the steps that led up to the trainer's room, about 6-7 steps led up from the lockers up to the trainer's room, when he flopped down and bent over, I could see that big number 13 on his back. And it was just a classic picture of defeat. But you know, that didn't defeat Ralph. He's had an outstanding career as a baseball player, as an individual. And now, you know, he's chairman of an organization called BAT, Baseball Assistance Team. And through Ralph's leadership and others on the board, former major leaguers, which I'm privileged to serve on, I watched Ralph in a very humane way, in a very dignified way, take care of big name, small name, any player who's had any big league time, in a very confidential way, gets assistance to some of these people who really need it, and who fans would just ache to know that some of these great players have fallen on hard times, health and financially. But Branca is a winner in the end. He's quite a man.
Good. Let me ask. I know about this, but let me just get you on tape on what you were doing since you finished baseball.
Okay, my last year was in 59 in Los Angeles, in which I retired mid-year with arm trouble, but stayed on as a coach. Then I left baseball in the end of the 59 season, went back to my hometown of Anderson, Indiana, and I coached college baseball to assist Anderson University for a few years. That was sort of a sidelight for me. I really didn't make a living at that, but I did have a chance to use all that baseball experience and knowledge with some good college young men. So we had some fine teams there, won the championship four times, I think, in my stretch. But my working life took a turn. I was in the insurance business for myself, then asked to serve on a bank board of a small little country bank that moved into our town of Anderson. The years have passed. I've been with the bank about 25 years. Went through the chairs, and 8 years ago, the board asked me if I would accept the title of president of the bank, which I never dreamed in my wildest that that would ever happen. So I have been president of our bank, First National Bank in Anderson, Indiana, working with a lot of people and families that I grew up with, and I know their kids or grandkids. It's just a beautiful second career.
Well, I knew that story, and I wanted to make sure that that we got that. If we have time, can you say something about the move to... Can you take something about the move to Los Angeles from Brooklyn?
Yeah, well, of course, when I came up with the Dodgers, Brooklyn was such a unique place, such unique fans, such a part of the life of Brooklyn. It was just a daily part of everybody's life. So we blended right into that, in the neighborhoods, and with the friends we made and the neighbors we had, and so just a beautiful relationship. Never dreamed that this, even though rumors were flying, never dreamed that they would actually move the team out.
Jerry Kuzma?
Jerry, how are you?
How are you?
Good to see you, Jerry. Never dreamed that we would have a change from the East Coast to the West Coast. But Juan O'Malley gets a bum rap in a way because he is the single figure that most Brooklyn fans hold up to be the cause. The facts really were, Mr. O'Malley tried desperately to keep that team in Brooklyn. I think there were powers beyond his control with the city of New York that blocked some of his futuristic thinking about building a stadium there in Brooklyn. He wanted to do that, and he was going to do it. But... when it became, the jet plane played a part in this too. When the jet plane came in, it was now possible to fly to the West Coast in a time that was without stops, and you could make a schedule. So Mr. O'Malley didn't invent the jet plane, but evolution of the plane came along at the right time, and it made it possible for a team to play in California. So they romanced him to the point where he decided maybe that's what I should do, and he had a pioneering spirit as well. And the owners, of course, said you have to have two teams go. You can't have one. You have to be at least two. So that's how Horace Stoneman was brought into picture, and two teams did move to the West Coast. The players never dreamed, even in spring training of 1958, the year that we moved, I don't think any of us realized the impact of that until we were on a plane flying to the West Coast to open the season instead of flying north, as we'd always done. And actually, we used to play our way north through a lot of cities from the south on up through to New York. And when we were on the plane flying to open the season on the West Coast, I think it finally hit the players. The New York era for the Dodgers is over.
It was something that I guess the true baseball fans haven't gotten over yet.
No, you're right. I still get a lot of mail and contact with Brooklyn Dodger people, and they still remember that team as the only Dodger team, really.
Yeah. Well, Carl, I certainly appreciate it. You've had a wonderful career, and you've had some interesting games. And would you say something about your injuries? Would you want to say something about the I got the feeling that the injuries played a role in an early termination of your career.
Well, there are a lot of guys that play hurt, and there are a lot of guys who are fortunate, I guess, that can avoid any serious injury and play a long time. I saw Jerry Kuzma come in here. He pitched for about 75 years or something. I don't know. He was very durable. Ryan Duran, I mean, Nolan Ryan was is another one that's pitched forever. Well, I always really was reluctant to be known as a sore arm pitcher, but the irony of that is that my first start in the big leagues, pitching in the rain against the Cubs, I did pull a muscle on the back of my shoulder. I re-pulled that many, many, many times after that, and it just dogged me through my whole career. I never let myself play the game and say, oh my, what would happen if I hadn't gotten hurt? That was part of it, part of the picture, and I learned to pitch with it. A lot of discomfort sometimes, but fortunately, I was not finished as some pitchers are. They hurt their arm, they just never recover. I was, even with discomfort, able to still have pretty good stuff. And I had stretches when spring was tough for me. Spring training was difficult. And with the competition for jobs in those days, I had some bad springs, got optioned back to the minors a couple times. I had to pitch myself back again, which made it even harder. But I stuck in 1950 and had some good days and played with a great team. In 53, I was 5-4 at the All-Star break. And Dressen said to me, you know, you got good stuff. You're pitching well, and you just seem to get beat on some fluke every time. He said, you need to change your luck. I'm going to take you fishing over the All-Star break. So he took me fishing over the All-Star break. In the second half, I was 15-2. That made me 20-6 for the season that led the league. That was my strongest stretch. I won 18 the next year. I was disappointed I didn't win 20 back-to-back. But I will say that in all honesty, the arm injury gave me both physical and psychological problems, just trying to keep myself right. But we had such a great team that somehow I roomed with Duke Snyder, and we shared a lot in the room about my pitching and my problems. And Duke had a few problems along the way, but we were good for each other, and that helped me a lot. I have no regrets about that, incidentally. I wouldn't ever want to take the position that I'm sorry it happened. Maybe it made me a better pitcher, I don't know.
Well, you turned out to have two wonderful careers out of it, and it wasn't like you had to find your way afterwards and you had cheated out of half a career or something like that.
No, that's true. Well, I was always a little disappointed that I couldn't stay in baseball. I love baseball, I still do. And one of the fortunate things is, going home to start a second career in banking, I've still been kept back into the picture through some special assignments with the Dodgers, through the Bat organization, which I've been on their board since it started, do some card shows, go to fantasy camps, do some special things for the Dodgers. So I still get to be a part of baseball, even though I couldn't stay in it as an active coach or some other capacity. But a Major League Baseball player never loses the identity. I don't care what else he does.
No, that's true.
He'll always be a Major League player. That's a wonderful identity to have.
Yeah. Well, Carl, thank you very much. You covered about everything that I wanted to cover.
You bet. You tell my friends at the organization I appreciate all their good work. I see a lot of the reports, and I once attended one of their meetings in Cooperstown.
Oh, uh-huh.
I took Peter O'Malley with me that night.
Oh,
we sat in on one of the meetings.
Well, I'm sure we'll turn this over to them for their consideration. Then. Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you.